Ticker symbol DNUT, or Donut, is in focus today on the Yahoo Finance platform. That's after the owner of that ticker, Krispy Kreme, issued better-than-expected full-year sales guidance. The company did, however, miss second-quarter analyst earnings estimates by a penny, despite seeing strong demand for its hot, soft donuts. Joining us now is Krispy Kreme CEO Mike Tattersfield. Mike, good to talk with you again here. I still don't think investors understand what you're doing with this hub-and-spoke model, where I believe I have it right, you order donuts online and you have it delivered from a location. Is that a profitable model? And take us through how you're expanding that.
No, so it's great to chat again, Brian. Good to see you. I really appreciate being able to chat with all the folks. Q2's performance was one of the best quarters that we've had as a public company, as we just came back. We just went public a little over a month ago. And it's really driven by two pieces. One, I'll get at the hub and spoke, but the first is just a global transformation where we actually now own six countries and also 85% of the U.S. The second part of that transformation allows to do exactly what you say is the hub and spoke system. So we rely on our theater shops, those hot light shops that a lot of the people around the world know, and then bring the hot donuts or bring fresh donuts to where the customers are in a fresh model distribution system. So really pushing on what I call points of access. And that's very different than what we used to do before. So it's getting points of access in an urban location. It might be in a fresh shop. It also might be in a grocer, and it might be in a convenience shop. And that also unlocks e-commerce. So that's very different than our past, which was a very typical franchisor model and just building out hot lights everywhere. We actually value scarcity, and the model now is really about, you know, producing amazing donuts, especially the original glaze, and then making sure that we can get it fresh to where the customers are. That's the difference in the model, and you can see it in the international business, which has actually been developing this omni-channel model ahead of us, and that's what we call it, and it's part of the hub and spoke is part of it, and it was built and designed that way, and their profitability that you can see in Q2 was significant because the frequency from the points of access, including our hot light shops, really worked. And you can see that in the performance.
It's also a different model, Mike, relative to a lot of your competitors. Are you gaining more shelf space in the likes of a Walmart and other grocery stores?
Well, the fresh model, we're starting to be, you know, here's the reality. The fresh will continue to build our model, and it'll be long-term 5 to 10% of ACV. So you got to think of our company a little differently. It's more of a hybrid CPG company with these amazing hot light shops that can do, you know, hot donuts, glazing and different flavors at that point, and then getting them to the point of access. The growth is going to be primarily through the grocery and convenience channels. We look at probably, we're going to do about 800 to 1,000 points of access on a yearly basis. And we've identified even the 30 countries, including the U.S. where we have today, about 6,000 points of access growth in front of us.
Mike, I think an asset that is in the business that perhaps people were reacquainted with through the public process is Insomnia Cookies. And I'm curious what that showed you in the second quarter. And as I associate Insomnia, I think about it from my college years. I associate it with a college campus or a college town. And, is that business maybe poised to have a stronger back half of the year with a return to more normalcy on, you know, most college campuses in the U.S.?
Yeah. So Insomnia is just a great, we took a majority stake and the partner, you know, the owner, founder, Seth, stayed with us, and he's really leading the team, and it's an amazing job. They did incredible last year as they evolved their business. They are an e-commerce primarily driven business, which is about 50% of it is. And they evolved into gifting and delivery as their main vehicle, even when colleges were in a hybrid state. So we see they just crossed their 200th cookie shop opening. And yes, we see as colleges return back to normal, we can see growth there. But the omni-channel model, both in Krispy Kreme and in Insomnia, just shows you the strength. Because even under last year, when it was really challenging to operate under the pandemic in both our brands, they had great years.
Mike, you didn't punt this question on the earnings call regarding inflation. You did say you are seeing significant inflation in oils, sugars, and that you are taking a price increase in September. How much more will it cost me to buy a Krispy Kreme donut in September?
You know, we're really disciplined on pricing. We're a dozens business, right? So, we do always pay attention to an accessible price point. So when you think about the pricing that will happen in a dozen, you won't really see it that much, right? We do sell dozens. We sell in occasions. We see the shift happening naturally. As people upgrade, for example, you just were mentioning, our s'mores donuts, right? Where they're a higher priced donut. So within the balance of mix and price, it's got to be worth it, right? And as long as we can keep it, you'll still see some price point around $1 per individual donut when you're looking at a dozen if you're buying original glaze. Somewhere around there, that doesn't mean we only hold at $1. We'll continue to look at, we do have pricing power. We're really thoughtful. And we think about it around the globe, right? That's one of the unique things about being a celebratory brand. And if people love you across all continents, and now we have a business model, which is pretty clear from the hot light theater shops to points of access, and then making sure that we can move our dozens of business, our donuts, and then they're used in celebratory occasions. They're used, all over the world for a pretty interesting aspect that the consumer wants to engage and enjoy.
Hey, Mike, it's Julie here. When you're talking about it's a dozens business, when people are coming into the store, how often are they buying a dozen versus a single donut? And then when you shift on over to delivery, what kinds of trends are you seeing there? Because I imagine, I don't know if you have a delivery minimum for people who are ordering from home, but it seems like margins are already tight on delivery. If you're just buying a donut and a coffee, that, it's not going to be worth a lot to you guys.
So because the brand is used a lot for occasions and as how people will celebrate and use our brand, which is pretty unique in its own right, about 75% of our donuts are sold in primarily in dozens. So that's a pretty unique aspect of that. That carries over as well into delivery. So we don't see one donut order. We see a dozen, sometimes even a two dozen order.
Mike, you're seeing on the screen those Hershey's donuts. Definitely, I would say innovation from you guys. What else do you have on tap from the menu innovation front? I know coffee has been a big focus by you as well.
Yeah, I mean, we're a donut company. That's one of the unique things that we really focus on and the change in the brand, because everybody asks, so what's different? I think I talked about last time, our focus on donuts and how we use even an innovation and to drive frequency. Last year, we sold 1.3 billion donuts. Since June 30th this year, we're at 750 million donuts. So the focus is about donuts and their occasion. That's where we spend our time and energy. That's what's really driving the brand. The growth is there. It's a frequency of getting to the points of access, the right innovation, and then locking e-commerce, which you can also get into gifting as well. So it's a pretty unique aspect of what we try to do. Beverages can play a role, but they play a role primarily in urban locations where we'll have a fresh shop, right, where someone will come in for beverage. But the old model of building a coffee shop, franchisor model, is not the model that we use today. And you can see the profitability and the change of the model in our more mature omnichannel model, which is our international business. And we just see tremendous growth opportunity, not just in the 30 countries we're in, but we proven this model works in all these continents, and we're actually now really looking at new geographies. In fact, tomorrow we'll open up in Egypt with our partner out in the Middle East. That's a population of 100 million in the country and 20 million in Cairo. So we just see, again, the accessible part of our brand. It focuses on donuts. The different channel approaches will have different product mixes, but it is a focus on doing donuts. 93% of what we sold in our retail shops were donuts.
Mike, real quickly, before we let you go, you mentioned you're opening in Egypt. You're making a big international push. I'm sure you've seen what's going on in Afghanistan. Does that push internationally into other Middle East countries, does that change the risk profile of a Krispy Kreme?
We use, again, partners in other parts of the world. So Americana is our partner there. They're one of our most successful franchisees. When we put our own capital in play, we'll do that. The world is continuing looking for our brand. That won't change how we continue to think about it. It's making sure the brand from its essence is to drive a joy and enhance the lives of others through Krispy Kreme. If we can do that in any country and if partners and we see a lot of folks really wanting to open up, we're just going to be really disciplined about how we expand international.
Fair enough. At the rate I'm going, my vacation might be to one of your stores to watch some donuts being made. It's been a heck of a year. We will. we'll leave it there.
Brian, and always, I thank all the Krispy Kremers for always just doing an incredible job across the globe for us.
You got it. Krispy Kreme CEO Mike Tattersfield. Have a good rest of the week.
Take care.
All right, welcome back to Yahoo Finance Live on this Wednesday morning. It's been a whirlwind couple of weeks for regulation of and in the cryptocurrency space, and stopping by to help us make sense of where we stand now and what the future might look like is Michelle Bond, CEO of the Association for Digital Assets Markets. Michelle, thanks so much for jumping on. Let's just start with kind of from your vantage point, what got into that infrastructure bill, what didn't, and what does it mean for the cryptocurrency space as we go forward here?
Yeah, certainly. Well, first of all, thanks so much for having me on. And we have had a busy few weeks in Washington. Certainly, we've had a lot of things with, you know, significant developments happening over the past couple of weeks. And I think it all underscores the need for digital asset, the industry, to have a coordinated and sophisticated approach to information sharing with policymakers. Because what we just saw play out with the infrastructure bill, It was an extremely difficult process. It's now headed to the House, and we'll see if the House is willing to reopen it. According to reports, Speaker Pelosi is not going to reopen the legislation for amendments. So it's unclear if any changes will actually be made in the House at this point. So we're still working on trying to get an amendment. Certainly the Senate did make significant improvements to the bill prior to introduction. However, there was a compromise amendment that did not pass via unanimous consent in that sort of like final stage on the Senate floor before going over to the House. And that has, so currently the language, there is some really problematic language for the industry that's contained in the infrastructure bill. Where it expands the broker definition, it raises questions about securities laws, and certainly there are some criminal penalties that are associated with failure to comply. So there are a lot of concerns that the industry has at this point, and you know, we're working very closely with the Hill and trying to see, you know, basically how we can get this fixed.
You know, Michelle, in your dealings with officials, do you get the sense they know really anything about cryptocurrency and where it might be headed over the next decade?
So, look, I think last week's fire drill was, honestly, I think it was related to the digital asset industry's failure to be fully plugged into the policymaking process. And this is really the second major fire drill that we've had in the past year. I think the grassroots engagement was nothing short of spectacular and a real testament to the technology and to those working in this field. But the reality is that digital assets are, you know, rapidly growing and will only attract more attention in Washington. So to answer your question, I think there is a lot more information sharing and engagement that needs to happen between the industry and policymakers. I think there is an enormous public interest and passion for digital assets. And I think that has to come to Washington a little bit more, because we cannot continue relying on grassroots advocacy and fire drills to protect this industry. I think the model is unsustainable. And I think it's going to be much more important to be fully integrated. And to be talking with policymakers on a day in, day out basis, and talking with them about, you know, the technology and the benefits and consumer protection and all of those things, so that we can sort of avoid this 11th hour, you know, regulation that we just saw happen, you know, with the infrastructure bill. And honestly, you know, it happened in December as well with the FinCEN unhosted wallet rule proposal as well. So it's not the first time this has happened. And I think we're going to be better off if we can see some more sophistication and outreach with policymakers at an earlier onset.
Hey, Michelle, it's Julie here. What exactly does that look like? I'm always curious about this in Washington, not just for crypto, but since we're talking to you and you're a crypto person, like, how do you get their ear? We know, you know, listen, we know how Washington works. We know that there's money greasing the wheels in some cases, right? There's donations to various campaigns or causes of these politicians. How do you get their ear? How do you I mean, crypto is an enormously complex topic. How do you communicate it clearly? Like, how do you make all of this happen?
So my organization, ADAM, is a standard-setting body, and we work with leading financial firms, entrepreneurs, regulators, and we set industry best practices and policies to facilitate fair and orderly digital asset markets. And so clearly the industry is taking a leading role in setting market standards and creating policy principles. And I think that's a critical way to advance the industry and to also ensure consumer protection without stifling any innovation. And I think that has been extremely effective with policymakers because they see that there's an industry group that is dedicated to market integrity. We're working in partnership with regulators. We have a code of conduct that we've advanced. And it's a really great way to have an adaptable, workable framework to protect consumers without stifling innovation. And that has been an extremely effective tool that we really enjoy, you know, talking with policymakers about, because they see that there is regulation in this space and that the market participants themselves are dedicated to setting industry standards. And also just to like raise awareness of how the markets work and who the participants are and how to root out fraud and those types of things. And that's really what our group is dedicated to. And I think that's a much preferable way to engage with regulators and policymakers more broadly, as opposed to sort of like, you know, the 11th hour grassroots campaign. Once like something's mm-hmm. already in legislation, I think it's a lot more difficult. So I think the industry really needs to be proactive in setting its own standards and working in partnership with regulators, to talk with them about the technology, the benefits, if there's any education that's required, and just engage on a daily basis. The Biden administration has created the crypto sprint with the banking regulators. The SEC is looking at this space. The CFTC is looking at this space. Obviously, Capitol Hill. So there are a lot of people who want to talk and who want to hear more. I think the opportunity is absolutely there. I think we just need to engage in a really constructive and helpful manner with these policymakers.
Yeah, and certainly a conversation that we know will continue. We'll leave it there for today. Michelle Bond, CEO of the Association for Digital Asset Markets. Michelle, appreciate the time this morning.
Welcome back. We're getting a fresh picture on the state of this hot housing market. The Census Bureau and HUD reporting this morning that U.S. housing starts dropped 7% last month to a three-month low. That's an annualized rate of about 1.5 million. But maybe some optimism in the ability to build more in the future. You can see building permits actually rose 2.6% to an annualized rate of 1.6 million. So does that suggest a cooling in that hot housing market? For more, let's bring in Odetta Cushy. She's deputy chief economist at First American. And Odetta, I guess there's a supply story that could be behind that decline when it comes to maybe not being able to have the labor or materials, but there's also the demand story, right? So maybe the highest of housing demand has passed. How are you reading the housing starts data that we got this morning and what that tells us about whether or not we reached the peak in this housing market?
Yeah, so an underwhelming report, but not unexpected. Builders are facing multiple supply side headwinds. We've all heard about lumber shortages, which luckily are starting to ease, but there's also skilled labor shortages, you know, shortages in appliances, and of course, buildable lots, lack of buildable lots. And then, you know, of course, builders have always faced regulatory burdens to building more homes. And so all of those are headwinds to building more homes, especially with the backlogs that builders are facing. Nowadays. On the demand side, it's all about benchmarks. Obviously, relative to last year when we had this unleashing of pent-up demand during the pandemic, mortgage purchase demand is lower than 1 year ago. But actually, if you look back before the pandemic, purchase demand is still at near decade high. You know, we're at about 2019 levels, which is the best in about a decade. And so it's basically like going from an extremely hot market to a hot market.
So the big question we've been asking for some time, when do we expect things to balance out?
So it's tough to, you really need to bring more supply to the market, right? The reason we're seeing double-digit house price growth is because there's this severe supply-demand imbalance in the housing market. And it won't be overnight. You can't just bring more inventory to bridge that gap overnight. So it'll be some time. But with that said, there could be some moderation in house price growth in the months to come because we are seeing affordability decline. And so you might see fewer bidding wars and some would-be buyers kind of pull back in this market, which should bring some moderation to house price growth, but it should still remain positive.
Now, Odetta, I guess one question naturally is that people saw what happened with this hot housing market in 2020, but I think a lot of people at the time were hoping that by the time we got to, you know, the late summer of 2021, those would have abated. Now, is there a demographic change in the types of people that are buying in 2021 versus 2020? Is it the same person that's buying a second house? Is it that same millennial that got a big windfall from a lot of the fiscal stimulus that we got that are doing this type of buying? Or is the demographic now and the geographic focus of where these houses are being bought different now than it was in 2020?
Yeah, this is a longer run demographic story. We're seeing a longer run shift from renting to homeowning that is primarily driven by, you know, the largest generation in history, the millennials. And so we're still seeing millennials out there. They had excess savings during the pandemic, and they're still looking to buy that first home as they age into these key lifestyle decisions that are highly correlated with buying a first home, you know, getting married, having kids, moving out to the suburbs. So we're still seeing a wave of millennial demand in the housing market today.
And Odetta, on the supply side, or specifically as it relates to materials and construction costs, what do you see the biggest headwinds right now? If we're talking about a potential leveling out down the line, what are some of the bumps we're anticipating in the next few months as we continue to see a bit of a backlog on the supply side?
Right. So builders are still facing backlogs. There's still homes that are sold that have not yet been started. And so builders have to make their way through those backlogs. But then, of course, there are all of these material shortages. And we do anticipate some of those supply bottlenecks to ease in the second half of the year, which is good news. And some other good news is actually that there's been a rise in residential construction employees. You know, you can't build more homes without more construction workers. And so it's good to see that number continue to rise. That should help ease the burdens that construction industry is facing as well.
Are there different trends between single family and then multifamily builds right now? I mean, obviously, when it comes to the building permits, if they did indeed increase in the month of July, there is, should be pointed out, a band of error that the Commerce Department, or rather the Census Bureau, reports alongside these figures. But do we know about the nature of these types of builds and also maybe where across the country we should expect to see that pipeline maybe beef up in the coming months?
So the rise in permits was primarily driven by multifamily, but as you mentioned, multifamily numbers tend to be quite volatile. With that said, we are seeing the multifamily sector regain momentum. You see rental prices increasing, specifically in Sunbelt markets as people start to move into some of these more affordable Sunbelt markets. You start to see rental prices increase. And so you do kind of see this the multifamily sector regain momentum, but we also need to see more building on the single family side because that makes up the majority of home building. And so it was good to see multifamily permits pick up, but we need to see that overall permits pick up as well.
Odetta Kuchi, first American Deputy Chief Economist. It's great to get your insight today. Really appreciate the time. Well, the continued shutdown at one of China's largest ports is threatening to disrupt shipping at ports around the world. The Ningbo Zhoushan Container Port has been partially closed for more than a week now since an employee tested positive for COVID at one of its terminals. All of this, of course, coming is here in the U.S. The Port of L.A. now sees 12 consecutive months of growth. For more on that, let's bring in the executive director of the Port of L.A. We've got Gene Soroka joining us. Gene, always good to talk to you. We spoke to you 2 months ago when there was another shutdown at a separate port in China. Looking at what's happening this time around, what does the damage look like for the Port of L.A.?
Minimal, but our first concern at KECO is the health and safety of the workers, making sure that folks are on the job and can do the work that's necessary. Not only our eye is on Ningbo today and central China, but factories throughout Asia, other ports and terminals as well, making sure that we curb and eradicate this virus once and for all. Ningbo represents about 3% of our weekly container lift coming here to Port of Los Angeles. And please know that the Port Authority has asked the cargo normally moving through that one terminal slide over to the other three. And also the great port of Shanghai at the Yangshan Deep Seaport is only a 3+ hour truck ride away. The industry will absorb this cargo. But again, our focus is on the workers and getting them back on the job in good health.
The stop and go that we've seen out of China is certainly emblematic of the uneven recovery or the bumpy recovery that's happening as a result of this pandemic. How has that disrupted things at the Port of L.A. at a time when where you've seen some significant pickup, especially as we spoke last time, you've seen pickup during the back to school season?
Akiko, as you know, the supply chain has been choppy for 3.5 years, dating back to the ill-advised tariff policies of the previous administration in Washington, the unevenness that was brought by the end of that tenure, and then COVID-19. Our business dropped in the first 5 months of last year by 19%. And then the American consumer's strength rose, and we've been off to the races ever since. But really, every day we're in the news and there's something that affects the supply chain to some person or group in it. So we're doing our very best to be resilient, be able to pivot and move forward by carrying the cargo. Our productivity here at the Port of Los Angeles has never been better. We're welcoming and working 50% more ships per day than we were pre-pandemic times. And for every vessel that comes to the Port of Los Angeles, we're exchanging loads and discharge of 11,000 container units per ship on average. That's the best in the business.
Hey, Gene, Brian Chung here. Are you doing all of that with fewer people? We know that this labor shortage has been impacting industries across the board. Obviously, longshoremen have also been a big story as we hear about these anecdotes of these ships that are kind of idling outside of your ports. So first of all, are you still feeling a labor shortage when it comes to your business? And then secondly, do you expect that to abate as we do get closer to the end of the year?
Yeah, good question, Brian. Nice to see you as well. Three big segments of labor, as you know, here on the ground. Our dock workers, 15,000 strong members of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, have been averaging 5.5 to 6 days of work since the pandemic began and safer at home orders were instituted back in March of 2020. We've added workers, both of the apprentice or what we call casual level, as well as registered A and B members. So we've got everybody out there on the docks working hard. We too, though, here in Los Angeles, are watching the Delta variant very closely. We've had some illnesses, including breakthrough illnesses, but nothing to impede the work on the ground. Second are our truck drivers. We have 18,000 that are registered to do business here at the Southern California ports, and we've got about half of those that call the ports on at least a once a week basis. There are truck drivers. We got to get them better turns. They're averaging about 2.1 turns per day. They need more than three to break even on their financials. And anything over that, hopefully we can get them into good middle class wages. We've got to loosen up the gates and get more turn times. Yes.
Go ahead.
The third segment is in the warehousing complexes. And that's where we're feeling the pinch, Brian, just a little bit. We've got a lower number of teams working and fewer in those teams because of the medical requirements of physical and social distancing. We've got to look at extended hours in that group as well. It's about 2 billion square feet of warehousing from the Pacific Ocean to the desert region in California.
Gene, you put out some new numbers yesterday. I mean, the good news is that you've got cargo volume up nearly, 40% here compared to 2020 levels. But you've essentially, since the beginning of the pandemic, been in a bit of a catch-up mode. One of the things that stood out to me is you talking about the tight space that you have in terms of warehouses and being able to house inventory. How are you sort of moving things around to handle that part of the equation?
That is the most complex piece of the entire equation. Factory output in Asia is as high as it's ever been, but they're still behind in orders. Ship space is not enough, even with 99.5% of all vessels deployed worldwide and in our Trans-Pacific arena. We've got 32 ships at anchor today awaiting berthing space, yet our productivity is higher than ever. It's kind of like squeezing 10 lanes of freeway traffic into five. Really, where it all starts is that the folks who are importing need to pick up their cargo faster and digest it into the domestic supply chain a little bit more quickly than we've been doing. There were 50 miles of trains outside the Chicago's suburban rail facility just a week ago. We've got to get that cargo moved through so we can get more capacity on the ground here in LA and bring more ships in. It is just a continued replenishment concept from major retailers, small and large alike.
And then, Gene, lastly, we've been talking a lot about China, you know, Yantian, Ningbo, obviously all of those, ports are in focus, but it's not just China. There are ports all over the world in areas that might also be getting ravaged by the Delta variant. Is there any sort of concern from your vantage point that there could be other port shutdowns in other critical markets as well that could impact what you're seeing over there on the West Coast?
Yeah, we're watching this every day, Brian. And again, with respect to Ningbo, it's one terminal out of four. There is capacity to absorb that cargo today. But the question is, what if and what's next? So we're watching very closely. We went through this in June, as Akiko said, down in South China with Yantian and other locations around Chiwan, et cetera. We'll be watching Southeast Asia as well, where we've had some outbreaks around the factory community. So this is not over yet. But again, every day we're facing something in the supply chain, and we've got to be resilient, pivot, and continue to move this cargo at even greater levels than we are today.
Port of LA Executive Director Gene Soroka, I really appreciate the update. Always good to have you on the show.
At a time when many businesses are shutting their doors because of the pandemic, Pedego is busy opening stores across the country. The electric bike brand has seen tremendous growth over the past year. And joining me now is the founder and CEO of Pedego Electric Bikes, Don DiCostanzo. Don, good to see you. Pretty impressive here to find that you have opened over 200 stores across this country during the pandemic. Tell us why that's happening, and are these franchised stores?
Well, it's happened because people want to get outdoors and they want outdoor recreation. And an electric bike is a perfect way to do that. You don't have to sweat. You can do as much exercise as you want or none at all, depending on what you want to do. And the four-letter word that keeps most people from cycling, which is hill, it goes away because it's actually more fun to ride one of our bikes up a hill than it is down a hill. As far as opening stores, yes, we've been very successful. The pandemic acted as an accelerant to our entire business model, including getting more people wanting to open up independent stores. We're not franchised. They're independently owned and operated. It's more like a license agreement where we license our Pedego name and our business processes at no fee in exchange for them, them carrying our product line exclusively.
Now, I know that you have invested quite a lot in small businesses and in entrepreneurship. In fact, you were recently awarded the highly coveted Entrepreneur of the Year Award over at Ernst & Young. So congratulations on that. How are you helping these people who are opening up stores and selling your brand? How are you helping them on the entrepreneurship journey?
Well, most of our store owners have never been in business for themselves. So we teach them everything. We teach them everything basically to start an LLC, to get insurance, to get computer systems. What we recommend, several different options on every front. We offer different insurance companies that we vetted. We offer them accessories. We do their website for them. We do everything a franchisor would do for a franchisee, except we don't charge for it, because our business model is to make them successful. And the more successful they are, the more successful we have. And the business model has worked very, very well.
So I mean, the business model, meaning that you get a cut of their revenue, I'd imagine.
No, we don't. The only way we make revenue is we sell them the product. So we don't take a cut of their revenue. All the revenue is there to keep, but the only thing they can represent is our product line. So think of maybe an ice cream shop. They have to buy their ice cream from the ice cream commissary. In our case, they have to buy the bikes from us. So our margin is made by selling them the bike. So when they're successful, we're successful.
Understood. So they are selling your Pedego bikes exclusively in their shops then?
That's correct. So we have 200 locations in the US and Canada right now, and they sell our products, they rent our products, they give guided tours on our products, and most importantly, they service them, because there are mechanical devices and eventually they will break. They'll need a flat change, they'll need a tune-up. And so having brick and mortar is actually our biggest hallmark to success, is being able to have people to try the bikes and to get them serviced afterwards.
I want to talk to you about where you see growth in your industry, because while we've seen this emergence of demand for e-bikes, we're also seeing a lot of food delivery companies getting lots of business. They're using a lot of e-bikes, yours and others, to get food to people. Are you aligning with any of the food delivery companies? And is that where you might see, you know, the most growth in the short term, at least?
Well, no, actually, the food delivery companies are just a very minute segment of the market, and an important one, don't get me wrong, but it's not what we focus. We focus on providing aging baby boomers, and now younger generations are now buying electric bikes. We see 16-year-olds and 18-year-olds getting electric bikes. Our original focus was the aging baby boomer looking to get some recreational fun. If you were 50 plus, you were our target market, because you had time and you were looking to get some exercise and you wanted to have some fun. And there's a social dynamic to it. So there's a lot of segments, just like this, everything electric. Let's face it, everything electric is just hot, whether it be cars, now planes, trains. Electric bikes are probably the fastest growing segment of any of these categories because they're affordable for everybody. And speaking of affordable, the governments are legislating and spending money in allowing, in subsidizing people to buy electric bikes. There's a law and there's a bill in the Senate and the House for up to 30% rebate on an electric bike. And California just passed a $10 million initiative to subsidize people to buy electric bikes as a tax credit, much like they did for electric cars. The difference is electric cars what I would consider about a 10% rebate. This is going to be a 30% rebate. So it's going to allow everybody to afford an electric bike.
So as demand goes up, that leads us to the next question, which is, what about supply? How is it to get these bikes in a timely fashion? If I want to go out and buy an electric bike, am I going to be waiting weeks, maybe months for my bike to come in?
Because we have six different factories scattered in different parts of the world, we have a steady stream of supply, and all of our stores have products in stock right now. You can go to any 200 and there are bikes there. We have a steady stream arriving every day, and we send them out almost as fast as they come in. So while we don't have an unlimited supply, anybody can go to a Pedego store today and buy a Pedego electric bike.
And what about price inflation? Our other big question we're asking folks across all industries, have you had to eat some of the higher costs of materials, or has the price, retail price of your bikes had to go up over the past few weeks?
Well, we've maintained our pricing. We have not had a price increase on any of our bikes for the past 2 or 3 years. We've absorbed 25% tariffs. By being more efficient. We've pushed some of the labor down to our retailers so that they could do it in instead of raising the prices. So we have a whole unlimited number of factors that are going up. And I'm not so sure how much longer we can hold our prices, but we're going to hold them until these rebates come into place.
Well, that's good news for folks looking for an electric bike. Don DiCostanzo, founder and CEO of Pedego Electric Bikes, thanks for your time today. All right, switching gears here now. Pro golfer Patrick Cantlay is celebrating finishing the end of the regular season as one of the coveted Comcast Business Tour top 10 athletes as he heads into this week's FedEx Cup playoffs, which tee off tomorrow in New Jersey with the Northern Trust. And we are delighted to have Patrick Cantlay with us right now. Congratulations, Patrick, on your third place finish there in the Comcast Business Tour top 10. Tell us what's on your mind. How are you feeling heading into the Northern Trust tomorrow?
Yeah, I think it's great. Start of the playoffs and no better place than up here, New Jersey, New York area. And we played the tournament up here a few years ago and I like it a lot. So should be a good week. It's always exciting this time of year. The golf, the stakes are up and it should be fun.
And exciting also because I believe you're going to be having some fans there, right, for the first time in a very long time since this pandemic. Tell me what you're expecting. What kind of energy do you expect to get from the folks that are going to be in attendance?
I think it should be great. Every time I'm in the New York area, I think, you know, I remember the PGA at Bethpage, the New York fans are fantastic, and they just add a little more excitement to the tournaments that are up in this area. And so it is nice to have the fans back, and I think that's such a great part of sports, and, you know, I'm really looking forward to getting the week started tomorrow.
Now, I know that your full-time caddy, Matt Minister, had tested positive for COVID-19, so he will not be there at Northern Trust for you. But you do have a pretty good backup. Tiger Woods caddy, Joe Cava, going to be substituting for us. I guess it's a substitution gig there this week only. Talk to me about working with Joe, and have you worked with him before?
Yeah, Joe's never caddied for me before, but, you know, I obviously know Joe a little bit. And spent some time with him at President's Cup, and he's a great dude and obviously a very good caddy. He's been doing it, I think he said, almost 35 years. And so, you know, he knows what he's doing, and he's a great replacement. So I couldn't ask for a better replacement. My caddy should be back next week, and I'm looking forward to Matt coming back next week.
Absolutely. And I know that you and Tiger Woods have grown quite close. Of course, Tiger still sidelined as he rehabs from that car accident in February. But I'm curious if you've talked to Tiger heading into the playoffs this week.
Yeah, we texted a little bit and I just thanked him for letting me use Joe this week and letting him off. You know, Tiger and I spent a little time. We both live Jupiter area, and we got close really for the first time President's Cup. He was the captain there when we went to Melbourne for the President's Cup, and he did such a marvelous job that week and really bonded with the guys. And, you know, we've played a little golf since then, and he's just a great dude. So we can't wait to get him back and get him back and healthy.
Patrick, I've got to ask you a money-related question here because you are on Yahoo Finance. And with a lot of these tours, there can be a nice purse associated with them. Of course, there are endorsement-type opportunities. I'm just curious, when you think about money, what's your priority in your life? And do you have an investing philosophy at all, Patrick?
Well, I'd say I'm only 29 years old, and so I try to take a very long-term approach. I wonder with all the enormous spending out there, you know, what's going to be left for my generation in 25 years. So that's a little concerning. But in general, I try to be very long term and fairly conservative. And it's definitely a big wide world out there that I'm getting more and more knowledgeable about. And so I try to really get some mentors in that area. And Marcus is a great outlet for me to learn more about that, my relationship with Marcus Goldman Sachs. And so, you know, I feel like I'm always learning. And so it's really exciting to feel like I'm being able to know more about it as I kind of get older.
Mm-hmm. That's a prudent approach there, Patrick. Patrick Cantlay, thanks so much for joining us, for making time for us. I know you have a busy week, and best of luck at the Northern Trust.
All right, about 16 minutes to the closing bell. We talk a lot about the economic resurgence as we try to emerge from the pandemic slowdown. But one of the companies that keeps a tab and a look on how the industries that all of us rely on are performing, especially when it comes to their future outlook, debt loads, all of it, is Rapid Ratings. And their CEO, James Gellert, joins us now because you've done some research and a lot of us were breathing a sigh of relief, but in your most recent note, I guess I'd say to clients, many industries are still in a state of financial weakness kept afloat by record leverage. So for those of us who are just average Jane and Joe investors, what are you telling us?
Well, Adam, I would never put you in the average category by any stretch. But you know, look, we're I think the important point is that, you know, from a headline perspective, people are paying attention to public companies and they're understanding how public companies are rebounding relatively well, and earnings in general across different industries are showing good signs of coming through this past year. But underlying that are a lot of indications that we're not through the woods yet. From a core health perspective, which is our measurement of the 2 to 3 year out fundamental view of how strong companies are, we've seen deterioration over the last, certainly during the course of 2020, and in many industries, even into 21. From a financial health rating perspective, which is the shorter term view, it still remains reasonably strong because companies have been able to raise such an incredible amount of liquidity, whether it's through equity or debt capital. But when you start to peel away layers of the onion, there are definitely causes for concern, given how much debt has been raised, how much liquidity is on balance sheets. And really the question is how long that will last before recovery in the underlying businesses really comes about.
And James, if we can pull up, I think it's the core health rating graphic that you sent us. We were just showing it on the screen. For the people watching, what you want to know is you have a statistic. Is it about when companies score at a certain level or below a certain level in their core health score, the potential for problems in the future is what?
So on our scale at 40 and below, that's where 90% of companies that have failed historically have been rated. That doesn't mean every company that's rated in that zone is going to fail, but it does mean that they're at significantly higher risk. So when you look at and this is an algorithmic process. So we're processing a tremendous amount of data on the financials of any company and profiling it against 12 million company years worth of historical financial data to come up with these scores. And what the core health is telling us is that there's been significant decline in a lot of these companies, in a lot of these industries, even those that have really cashed up. And what you see in some of the industries, like the ones on screen now, you see autos and business products and services, consumer products. These are ones that have raised a lot of capital in this past year. For instance, the autos reduced their current liabilities significantly, and the cash to current liabilities last year went up 57%. So it's a significant number, but it's also, that's kind of a relatively common theme across industries for this past year. But what you're seeing in the first half of 21 is that they're beginning to burn down that cash. So the auto industry, as an example, has burned down 17% of the cash that that was raised during the course of last year. If the underlying industries don't pick up, or if even worse, things turn worse through greater shutdown with the Delta variant, et cetera, we could end up in a situation where there's further deterioration of these industries before they're able to pick back up using the cash that they have raised over this past year. And with such an incredible access to capital over the last decade, but particularly with government support during the pandemic, most companies have been able to raise money, public and private. I'll give you one more example. In the transportation industry overall, if you look just at the public companies there, it's significantly less capital that's been raised than if you include the privates as well. You look at private companies, there's about 48% increase in debt across the board.
James, this is Emily. I want to ask, if I'm an investor and I'm seeing some headlines occurring, a company is, you know, raising debt or conducting a financing round, how should I be thinking about whether this fundraising and this access to liquidity is ultimately going to improve the core health of the company or just provide a temporary lifeline?
Well, excellent question, because it's very difficult to know that. Generally, you have to pay very close attention to what the company states its use of proceeds is going to be. General corporate purposes is what a lot of companies will say, and that's a giant basket. So it's really about paying close attention to the the quarters after a capital raise to see whether the new money that's come in is being put in place, is being used efficiently to create greater returns on assets and to ultimately be affecting profitability. And at the end of the day, the purpose of these companies is to generate returns for shareholders. And if they're just able to burn capital to stay afloat, that's not generating returns for anybody, really.
All right. We appreciate you joining us. James Geller, Rapid Ratings CEO. Always good to see you.